Okay, well, thanks for having me here. This is sort of work from my thesis under the supervision of my advisor, Dr. Charmaine Dean, and it's sort of based on this functional data approach to the analysis of recurrent event panel data. And actually, a lot of this work was sort of sparked and generated by some very interesting data that we've gotten from these biologists that work on pest control at Simon Fraser. And I'll get back to that in my example. Okay, so the idea is we're following a group of people over a certain amount of time, and we're going to observe some recurrences of some event of interest. And we have this sort of notion that there's this underlying functional mechanisms or functional mechanisms that are driving these recurrence pattern that we're going to see. And we're going to assume that this recurrence functions are without, if we don't have any other a priori information, are nice and smooth, have some sort of smooth form. And so I'm going to focus in on splines for the estimation of this these functional mechanisms. So we're dealing with longitudinal data, obviously, so we have to deal with within individual correlation, but also we'd like to deal with between individual correlation. So we have this idea that there's these functional mechanisms that are driving this recurrence rate. So it's sort of natural to assume that certain of these functions are influencing an individual more strongly than another's, and that certain individuals will all sort of focus in on, or certain individuals will focus in or be more drawn to a certain recurrence function or this functional mechanism. So we've got this sort of idea of clustering, so individuals following specific recurrence rates. Ideally, what we would like to have is follow everyone continuously and observe the exact event times. But often we can't do this. For example, with certain animal populations, you can't put a tracking device on a moth, for instance. So what we do instead is set up a sequence of follow-up times and observe the number of events that we have within each of these time intervals, sort of panel data. Okay, so I'm just gonna. I know you all know what panel data is, but just for notational purpose, the TIJs here are these follow-up time periods. And so an individual comes in at time TI naught, and we follow them up to TI EI. And within each of these time intervals, we're going to observe the number of events that they experience in that time interval. I've put the subscript I on these guys. So that everyone can have their own set of follow-up times. And the reason why this is important is what often happens is a scientist can't get out to the trap. An individual misses a follow-up, and so we may lose, for example, TI2. And so instead of having that panel there, we now aggregate and we have the number of events that would have happened between TI1 and TI3. Okay? And so each individual then has essentially a vector of counts. All right, I'm going to heavily use splines, so just a little background. I'm sure you all know what splines are, but splines are sort of smoothly connecting piecewise polynomials. And with the smoothness is that these connecting points are the knots. And they form linear spaces, which is nice, so that if we're trying to estimate functions, we can represent them as linear combinations of basis functions that span this space. So that would be great if that were as easy it were. You could just take these linear combinations and put them into the linear component of the models that we like to use, generalized linear models, and just have at it. Unfortunately, the number of basis functions you have and how you position those basis functions has a very strong effect on the kind of functions you can estimate. So to deal with this problem, there's sort of two general kind of methods of going about it. The one is to just throw down a really dense net of basis functions and penalize the amount of flexibility these basis functions can have. So you're using sort of an empirical Bayesian shrinkage type approach. The second approach would be to sort of try to find optimal positions and placements of these basis functions. And so I have a little graphic that kind of demonstrates this. So these are the basis functions for two. So the colored guys are each the basis functions. So we're going to represent functions as linear combinations of these functions. So the first one here, we have a basis that's constructed with breakpoints at 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, and 0.8. And so what you see here is that we have more basis functions in one area than in the other. So we're going to be more adaptive at the beginning than at the end. In the second one here, we're throwing down a really dense net of these functions, and we're going to use a penalty to make sure that the amplitudes don't wobble too much between these functions. The first approach actually helps you out a lot if you really believe there's a greater deal of oscillation at the beginning of the function than the end of the function. And the reason why that would be important, the reason why that gives it sort of this local adaptiveness is the penalty approach. The penalty is based on all the basis functions. So you're going to underfit in the first half and overfit in the second half in that case. Okay. But they are actually a lot easier to compute out than this, than the free knot approach. The free knot approach actually adds quite a bit of computational overhead. So unless you have some reason to believe that this is happening, this is probably the better approach to go. Also, how you specify your penalty function gives you some flexibility on putting some constraints on the functions if you a priori believe it to be sinusoidal or whatnot. All right, so now I'm going to jump into the modeling framework. So I'm going to denote M as a mixing distribution. We're new here as a vector-valued vector or a vector-valued component. And I'm going to assume that conditional on this random vector, each individual is going to follow a counting process that's following an NH non-homogeneous Poisson process with an intensity that I'm going to denote by lambda. All right, and so of course the cumulative density function is the integral of this intensity from onset or the beginning of the study up until time omega. So each individual has this vector of counts. So the number of counts that are observed to happen between each of these follow-up periods. And so the unconditional distribution then is essentially we're multiplying these Poisson distributions and integrating out the random components. And so this is going to give us an expectation vector, so an expected value for the number of counts we'd expect in each of these panels. And each of these guys, so the expected number for individual I and the jth panel is going to be the expected value of the difference of the cumulative intensity at the beginning and end of that panel, and expectations over M of the mixing distribution. Okay, so I'd said that we have this notion of this functional, this sort of smooth function generating our counts. And so I'm going to represent this intensity as a spline. And so here the gammas are actually splines. So we have a spline for the baseline and a spline for each of the covariates. And so actually xi here is the covariate process, and we need to know the covariates at least one point within those time panels. And then the new I are random effects. Okay, so essentially each individual is going to have their own spline, and it's regulated by the random components and their covariate effects. I've also considered actually, so I'm putting it up in the exponential here, and that's because we want the intensity process to be positive. We don't want a negative intensity, obviously. Another way is to sort of use an identity link that I've thought of. And so that would switch this from sort of a multiplicative type model to an additive one. And this gives us a little bit of a better intuition of the interpretation that we would have there. The downside there is now you have to impose some constraints on the parameters to keep it from going negative, right? Which we definitely don't want. As far as the optimization goes, that's not a problem. The issue comes in with inference, okay? So like I said, these gammas are splines, so we can write them as a linear combination of those basis functions. And then I'm going to use psi to denote the coefficients for each of the spline coefficients associated with the multiplier for those basis functions. And to complete the specification, I need to set down a series of knots, or some of these grid points that we're going to use. And what I'm going to use is I'm going to use the midpoints of all distinct panels. Okay. So this could be a pretty dense set of knots. And I'm going to use a penalty method. All right, I'm generally going to assume that P is not too big. If it does get really big, this is a case where this free knot approach would be quite useful, right, because you are using way fewer parameters. And so the extra computational effort that you would put into adaptively placing these knot positions is offset by the fact that if you were to use sort of this penalty approach, you're going to have to solve these ginormous inverses for these ginormous matrices. Okay. And in the cases I'm looking at later, these covariates are generally discrete, so they're like a treatment. So you have a baseline and a spline for each treatment. All right, so we need to compute out these quantities, the integral from the beginning to the end of the panel for those expectations. Because we've thrown everything up in the exponential, this doesn't have a closed form, right? Which it would if we were to use sort of the identity link, which is another reason why you might want to consider that. Of course, there's no closed form expression for that, so what I use is basically a Q-point Legendre-Gauss quadrature. And so this is you would actually have Q times the number of panel quadrature points. And I normally use 4 because that would assume that you could basically exactly approximate a polynomial of up to degree 8 in each of those panels. And so most of the cases I have, you can actually compute things out to machine precision, so it's almost not even an approximation here. And because we put things up into the exponential there, it's always positive, so the cumulative intensity is going to be monotone, like we want it to be. All right, so back to the idea of these sort of finite mixtures of Poisson processes, non-homogeneous Poisson processes. So why would we want to consider this approach? There's a couple I can think of. One is that you actually believe that there is some sort of hidden subpopulation. So we have these functional mechanisms generating our counting processes, and we believe that there's some hidden subpopulations that gravitate towards either one of these functions, let's say. That's sort of an empirical view. Another is sort of a mechanistic view. We actually want to decompose the intensity into some sort of components, basically factoring out that functional form into sort of simpler components that might have greater interpretation for us. And of course, doing this, we're actually going to enforce this within individual correlation. Okay. All right, so before I sort of add the window dressing for how you do the full finite mixture type approach, I would want to discuss how I would do it for a single cluster. So if we had just one cluster, so there's no finite mixture anymore. And I'm going to propose to you sort of a simple heterogeneity model. So you have to consider now that we don't want to do anything too fancy, because as you cluster, you could actually have a low number of individuals in each of these subclusters. Okay. So I'm going to assume that in this case that each individual has their own individual random effect, nu I. It's multiplicative. Mean 1 variance tau. And so we're going to express the intensity as sort of that spline that I showed on the previous slide times this random component. And so then our unconditional expectation, because the expectation of nu is just 1, is going to have this form, just the difference between the cumulative at the beginning and the end of those panel points. All right, so I'm going to approach this in sort of an estimating equation approach. So we've got this big psi vector, and each of those psi's is a vector of the B-spline coefficients for each of those splines. Okay? And so the estimating equation is in two parts. The first part, I'm sure you all recognize, so you have the vector of counts for each individual minus the mean. First point is sort of your regular estimating equation. So d is the derivative of that mean with respect to the size, and vi has the form represented up there, which is sort of from this negative binomial model. Although we're not assuming that here. Oops. Okay, and then the second component are those. We have to impose this penalty. We've way over parameterized the model. We need to control the flexibility of these functions that we're going to estimate. And so delta here is actually a vector of penalty, or see the smoothing coefficient. So we have 1 for each of the splines up in that lambda, in the intensity, sorry. And then the Kronecker product, because we have all these different splines, right? And actually we have sort of a particular form for this guy. The outer product of the first derivative of these basis functions, these B-spline basis functions, integrated over how long we've watched each individual, and then you sum over all the individuals. So if you're keen on splines and have done a lot of spline smoothing, you would sort of notice that you would normally take second derivative here. And the reason why I don't want to do that is because with this form of the penalty, as those as these coefficients, these smoothing coefficients, get very large, it implies that the splines are going to a constant. So it's pushing things to one degree of freedom, and that's pretty good. So we're going to be estimating these deltas, and there are cases where they sort of get very, very large. The data is saying, well, there's no need to do well. There's no need to put any extra degrees of freedom here. So what's going to happen actually is you're going to have a baseline intensity times e to the x beta here. So essentially going to a proportional intensity form. In the most extreme case, your overdispersion parameter is going to zero. All your smoothing coefficients are going off to infinity. You're going to be doing Poisson regression. So it's basically, I'm not going to propose that this is a test or not, but when the data is saying that these parameters are diverging off like that, and it's saying, well, Poisson regression is the best you can really do. And since we're dealing with counts, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Smoothing parameter. All right, so I'm using sort of a restricted maximum likelihood estimator to estimate these smoothing parameters. So you solve for the spline coefficients, update the smoothing parameters, so there's one for each spline, and then iterate. This converges pretty fast. I'm not going to get into the details of that. Those of you who are interested, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. It's essentially an empirical Bayes hybrid type approach, REML. Okay, so finally, to sort of finish off the specification, we need estimate of this overdispersion parameter tau, and we're going to use sort of pseudo-likelihood estimating equation, I think originally proposed by Davidian and Carroll. And it's sort of the difference between the empirical variance and the model-based variance. The extra term we're adding in there is a small sample correction. Once again, some of these clusters could have a small number of individuals, and we're going to require that. So this is what the first-order correction term would look like. I generally use a higher-order term because you actually, for the extra, I would never even dare to put it up on a slide. It's a sort of horrible-looking equation. But you actually get some gains doing that. All right, so back to the finite mixture. So that's how we would just estimate these functional forms within one cluster. So now I'm going to add what we need to sort of do this finite mixture approach. All right. So essentially, we're going to assume that within each cluster, we have a model like I just sort of went through before. So that would be this first term up here, the new I times the spline intensity. And so G here is the number of subgroups. Okay, and we're going to decompose it into these subgroups, and the I is an indicator of group membership, which we don't know, of course. Oops. So you can actually compute out the mean. You sort of, it's going to be sort of the linear combination of the probability of group membership times the difference between the cumulative intensity at the beginning and end of that panel for that group. And so estimation is going to follow actually very similarly, except for now we have a big psi for each group. All right. So that's why we've got all these subscript g's. The one little difference here is we now have this, we have these weights here. And these are essentially posterior expectations of probability of group membership, or probability of group membership, posterior probability of group membership. Remember, they're indicators, so it's the same difference. And so we're going to do a similar thing. We're going to have a tau within each cluster. We have to estimate those as well, and we're going to get a weighted sum of those pseudo-likelihood estimating equations. And now we have to add two extra equations to estimate these probability proportions, and there's only going to be g minus one of them, right? And it turns out there's a closed-form solution to this guy. It's just the sum of these weights over the number of individuals. And, of course, these weights, using old Bayes' rule, no problem. I'm sure you've all seen this before, anyone who's done with mixtures or dealt with even the EM algorithm. The only difference here now is that we have this new star because each cluster is just depending on their own random coefficient, individual coefficient. And I'm going to do a little cheat here. I'm actually going to use the posterior expectation under a gamma frailty assumption, where the Ni plus is the cumulative sum of those counts. It has a closed form because it's because of conjugacy, right? So I'm actually now making sort of a broader distributional assumption. You could actually use sort of a quasi-likelihood for those p's up there if you want it. But I didn't notice any difference when I sort of tried to see if that approach would make things any better. All right. So what do you do? So how you're going about this estimation is you solve the estimating equation, update your smoothing parameters, update your individual random effects, update probability of the group membership, and then you iterate. It's essentially an EM algorithm. Problem is that as soon as you start doing clustering, it's sort of a notoriously difficult problem because you have all sorts of local optima, right? I didn't actually want to talk about this very much, but anyways, I will. To initialize this, you actually have to have some sort of guess about group membership to start it off. And generally, we don't know that, right? So I'm just going to start off with a random initialization, and you run it for a while. It will converge. So you basically converge to a local mode. And so actually what we want to do is increase the energy state as we move through. The idea of a directional derivative is the same kind of thing that you would get in nonparametric maximum likelihood, sort of the VEM algorithm or VDM algorithm proposed by Boning, Lindsay, and L'Esperance in different work. Sort of, it's a similar type quantity. And what it does is it searches along areas of high probability of another cluster. And so what you do is this is the key to the algorithm here, being able to do this effectively. And this works pretty well if there is actually quite a difference between these underlying functional forms. If they're very similar, just sort of a phase transition, you have to put some serious work into the second part. So if you find another thing, what you would do is you would try to sub it in and see sort of a weak, strong cluster substitution, and you'd start again. And this actually works pretty well. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to jump onto an example here. So Cherry-Bartorchik data. So this is an experiment to test the effectiveness of this pheromone-based mating disruption on the Cherry-Bartorchik moth. So there's 20 trees, and they're all outfitted with a trap and dispenser. And then we randomly chose 10 of them, and we filled those dispensers. And the idea is the ones that have filled dispensers will confuse them, and they won't get trapped. In this way, we keep them off these. This is actually not a super serious study, but it's very similar to what I'll talk about in sort of my future work. These trees are ornamental trees that are in the boulevards, and these moths destroy them, right? They're very expensive trees, actually. So taxpayers decided they wanted to get rid of these moths that have been destroying their pretty trees. So these tracks were checked weekly for 19 follow-ups, so we have 19 panel times. They're interested not only in the effectiveness of this trap, the effectiveness of the treatment, but they're also interested in trying to figure out pinpointing exactly the times when the big mating rushes occur so that they can focus their energies at those times instead of wasting money through the whole season. And then the baits were refreshed every 3 weeks. This isn't actually really a confounding factor at all because they refresh them way more often than would be necessary. They actually last like over a month at full potency. So we fit the data, and it actually picks out three components. So adding any more components, the probability of group membership is essentially going to zero. So what you see here, basically in all these groups, you're getting sort of this multimodal action, and these are these waves of mating, right? And this is the baseline. I'll get to that in a second. What I want to kind of point out is pretty neat here. This green curve is essentially picking out what they call the instars, and these are moths that go into sort of a hibernative state over the winter, and then they come out ready to breed early in the summer. And they tend to, they're older, obviously, and a little bit smarter and wiser. Not only do they breed early, they breed at the peak season. And so if you could get rid, so these are the estimates of the cumulative intensities, if you could get rid of these guys, find some way of nailing these instar state moths, you could probably alleviate some of the problem. So these are the estimates. Actually, and this is an exact case where the smoothing parameters are actually going off to the bounds, forcing these treatment effects. So it's essentially proportional intensity sort of model. And that's good because I knew this was true from a lot of testing and working with this data. So I was kind of happy to see this. But what I wanted to point out here, which is kind of neat, is that The instars are also less affected by the treatment, so I guess they've gotten wiser. They've been with the ladies and they know how to avoid the trap, which is also more reason to try to get rid of them. All right, and so we've actually decomposed that guy into those three functions. So the sort of general mean term looks like this with 95% confidence bands. And so essentially this is linear combination with the probabilities attached to those functions you saw in the previous slide. So we're sort of decomposing this function into those three recurrence rates. Oh, traps. So they're catching moths in traps and counting the number of moths in the trap. Because you're going to catch more moths when they're in their mating season because they're going for the pheromone. So they come in these waves. Sorry, I'm not explaining things very well. All right. Now, in a similar way, actually, since we have all these individual posterior probabilities, we can get individual specific curves as well. And they look like this. This is pretty busy. So this is for all 20 individuals at their intensities and their cumulative intensities. And so as the number of clusters goes up, the limiting case is sort of a nonlinear mixed effects model, in essence, because of how we put the splines into the integral of that up into the exponential. We take an integral of sort of a nonlinear mixed effects type model. So just pull out a couple of them. There's a sort of recurrence rate for the tree 9 and tree 17. All right, so some estimates. Because those treatment splines are going to a 1 degree of freedom, so I actually have an estimate of what those treatment effects would be. So these are the three groups. So the instars, you can see, they have sort of a lower, still significant, though. So the treatment does work. It confuses them off. And there's quite a bit of dispersion in each of these components. And actually, they're sort of divvied out reasonably nicely to the three groups, which is not always the case. If you add an extra component, it goes off to zero. All right, so let's take a simple, I've done a lot of simulations, but I'm going to take a really simple case. So I'm going to generate three components from a finite mixture of these mixed NHUPP models within each cluster. And I'm going to do it from three forms, sort of a flat one, which would be like a homogeneous Poisson process, a good treatment where it starts off serious and then it trails off, and then a bimodal. All right, so I'm going to generate 80 individuals with 30 follow-up times each and with probabilities of being in any of these three groups, 0.1, 0.4, 0.5, and varying degrees of overdispersion in each cluster, this one being the most severe and this one still being reasonably high. So we'd expect not to do so well because on average we're really only using 8 individuals essentially to sort of estimate that guy. So I'm going to show sort of how it picked things out here. So the solid lines are the true curve. So this is my good treatment, homogeneous, and the bimodal curve. There's actually some bias in here, and you'd expect that, actually. I mean, we're not using a lot of data to try to pick that out. So these are the simulated means of the functions that we're pulling out. And because of actually the discrete nature, we're having a hard time picking up these curves here. So if you actually believe that there is some sort of, you have some idea of what this function is, it would actually give you some idea of how you would want to set up your follow-up times. All right, and so here's some estimates. Coverage probabilities for those intensities, I've sort of got an approximation there because they're, so sort of an average of what you would see over the whole point-wise for those splines. You can do a simultaneous confidence interval if you want as well, but then it will overfit a bit. So you'd expect to do badly in here. This is the component where you have a low probability of association with it, and you're still doing all right. In the other two groups, we're doing okay as well. Okay, our overdispersion, these are walled-type confidence intervals, these 95% confidence intervals, and these are overdispersion parameters. If you actually wanted to test When these are zero, you would want to use like a score equation, okay? I've done actually a lot of simulations, and I'm amazed that this actually works, to be honest, sometimes. But where it actually gets flubbed up, I'll jump right out and be honest, is when you actually have these functional forms that are very similar, if you just have some sort of translation shift. So you actually, would, in some ways, would have to correct for this translation. So if the humps happen at sort of different times, these waves of mating were to come at different times of the season, it would have a hard time picking up these, would sort of start clustering them together, and you wouldn't be able to pull out these two functions. All right, let's see if I can squeak this in. So the future, I'm actually interested in the spatial component, and the reason why I am is because I have that data set that I showed you with moths. I have a similar data set. So this is the whole Okanagan Valley, and these are apple orchards, and they have a problem with this codling moth that exhibits sort of a similar type pattern. And so questions of sort of, is there a spatial relationship, and if we can use this spatial relationship to our advantage, and also to sort of predict their migration patterns to this region. And you would be able to do that by some sort of spatial of the phase shifts, or a spatial random component for a phase shift. Although I'm really keen to start working on this. Charmaine says I have to finish writing up my dissertation before I can play with this, though. So, all right, so I'm also interested in, okay, what's the, there's been efficiency studies that say, okay, you have event times, and instead now you have counts. So the difference between the loss in efficiency of having the complete event times or just using counts. I'm interested in something similar for the panel data. So how much are you losing out by paneling this data? Other questions are, how would you actually set up these follow-up times in a sort of a design of, for a design aspect? How would you like to optimally position these things to do the best if you have some idea or notion of what the underlying function you're trying to pick up look like? And this actually, I think, has a very close relationship in the spline case to trying to optimize those knot positions, because there's this relationship between the panels and the knots. I'd like to investigate that a little bit. So for inference, I've been using estimating equation pro, so I've been using a robust sandwich variance type estimator, which is good if you're assuming that the number of clusters is fixed. If you don't, it's not so good anymore. And so I've been playing around with estimating equation bootstrap. And the reason why I wouldn't want to do a full bootstrap is sort of bootstrapping from these refitted models would be really difficult. This would be an efficient way. Estimating equation bootstrap hasn't caught on much. It was proposed by Cabflish and Fu, I believe. And in the simpler cases, it works fabulously. So I'm going to try to sort of adapt this to more complicated models. And so actually, going back to number one, now since you have the spatial, we have this ginormous data set, I'm going to need better, faster algorithms. Actually, they're pretty robust. They need to be faster. Okay. Thank you very much. No, not necessarily. There's a couple where what happens is they couldn't get out to the traps, so then you get like an accumulation between two panels. So one individual would have two panels and one would just have one less panel, but you would accumulate the number of counts that you've seen because the traps still keep collecting. I mean, if that goes on for too long, you could have some confounding where the traps get full. But right. It gets a little bit more, but I'm actually I've developed quite a bit of software for this, and I'm going to put it as a package with R to do all this kind of stuff. Is it difficult? No, I mean not really. I don't think if you can actually get the equal space panels at an extra 1,000 lines of code or something to get it going for the general case, but. But the efficiency loss question, like I said before, is something I'm interested in, and I'm actually, that's sort of the final, the downward stretch of what I'm working on right now. Right. Well, if you, My idea is I would start low and just keep adding components. If you're really finding, if you're doing a good job with that directional derivative, you're actually finding the true global max for each of those subcomponents. And as you add components, eventually one of them is going to drop off to zero. If you're interested in saying just two components, then you would just fit it for two components. I mean, even though I'm adding components, I still pretend like once I found the model that the number of components is fixed for, from an inference point of view. And that's where this would sort of come into play. I don't know if I answered your question.
I have a question. You start